Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast for the March issue of the Aldi magazine with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi. And in the March issue, we've got a terrific article by the actor Michael Simpkins about appearing on both stage and on screen and not knowing while filming or during rehearsals whether your play or film is going to be a hit or a massive flop. And Mike, in your very enjoyable article, you start by talking about a series that I'm afraid I've never heard of, which is called Castles, which you describe as a middle-class EastEnders. And everything looked good when you were filming, is that right?
Yeah, it did, Harry. I always specify that the nature of acting, the job of acting, is that you're essentially on a tightrope, one on which one side lies triumph and the other side lies doom.
Right.
And when you step out onto the tightrope with each new project, you never know whether you're going to fall one way and it's going to make your career or it's going to be an absolute flop. And Castles was one of those projects that every jobbing actor from time to time gets where you suddenly think you've hit the jackpot. This was a 14 or 16 part BBC middle class soap opera. I was Philip Castle, who was the eldest son of the Castle family, who run, as far as I remember, a furniture business. And so there were all the machinations of that, who's getting married to who, who's having the affairs, what's happening to the business, all that. And I thought, this is it. And we were front of the Radio Times for the hour-long omnibus edition. And I thought, this is it. Next stop, Hollywood.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the crucial opening double episode, which the BBC chose to broadcast two in one go so that the audience watching the first episode could really get a big helping of who everybody was and everything. This crucial episode on which everything hangs, because if people don't watch the first episode, they tend not to watch the second,
yeah.
And you're already sunk. This first episode coincided with not only the hottest summer's day of the year, which was a Sunday, but also with the quarterfinals of the Rugby Union World Cup, in which England were playing a crucial match, I think, against South Africa. And I knew we were in trouble because just as the opening episode of Castles was coming up, it was about 20 minutes till broadcast time, I decided to nip down the off licence to get some fortifying drink,
yeah,
with which to watch myself for the next hour. And as I passed the streets on the way to the off-license, every window was open because it was so hot, and every window was broadcasting the Rugby Union World Cup quarter-finals. And I knew then that nobody was going to watch it. Needless to say, it was watched by an audience of about four, one of which was my mum, and she admitted she fell asleep halfway through the second half. And as it turned out, Castles sunk without trace, and it never got commissioned for another series, and I've never been on the front of the Radio Times since.
And then actually, by contrast, you describe appearing in A View from the Bridge, the famous Arthur Miller play, and you thought to begin with, despite it being a famous play, that wasn't going to work out. Is that right?
Well, we knew that with doing an Arthur Miller play at the National, we knew that it was going to have a half a chance, particularly as A View from the Bridge is a very great play.
Yeah.
I think there were raised eyebrows at the National because Alan Ayckbourn, who directed this production of A View from the Bridge, brought largely a regional company of actors with him, of which I was one. And I know there were a few upturned noses at the National thinking, who are all these provincial actors? They're not going to be able to manage Arthur Miller. The other thing, of course, is that Alan, as a director and as a writer, is known for comedy. And I think there was a slight sense in the building of, will Alan be able to deal with what's a very heavyweight, typically, you know, muscular Arthur Miller play? However, Alan is a genius, and therefore he cast Michael Gambon as Eddie Carboni, and Gambon was just approaching his greatness then. He was like watching a bear on stage. It was just a performance he got hold of. Alan directed it with extraordinary deftness. Nevertheless, the point is, we didn't know until the first preview whether it was going to be quite... We thought it would be quite good, or it might be good, or it might be a smash. And we finished the first preview, and the audience clapped very politely, and we all came off thinking, well, we got away with it, and we went back into our dressing rooms and did a lot of air kissing and hugging, and we took our costumes off, ready to go to the bar for notes with Alan. And it was only about 4 minutes into this procedure that somebody noticed that the audience was still clapping over the tannoy, and indeed the clapping wasn't diminishing like it normally would, it was growing. And after about another minute or two, the stage manager ran down to the dressing room and said, "For Christ's sake, come back there, you know, they want more." So we went back. I remember Gambon was in his vest by this point. He'd taken half his costume off. We looked like something out of Steptoe and Son. But it was funny that as we walked onto the stage, we must have been off for 5 or 6 minutes since we first disappeared, the audience stood and roared. And many of them were in tears. And it was then that a sort of feeling spread along this line of slightly bewildered and shell-shocked actors that we had hit on something very special. But the point is that we didn't know that while we were playing it, and we didn't. What we needed was, it's the audience that tell you what you've got. You may think you know what you've got, but the audience are the critical component in any live performance.
And even though there you had a great play, great director, great leading actor, even then, as you say, those aren't enough ingredients in and of themselves.
No, they aren't, because they're all, you know, it was William Goldman, it's a well-trodden phrase, so forgive me, but, you know, he famously said, in show business, nobody knows anything.
Right.
And great it's line, so yeah. true. And that is why you get so many terrible Hollywood films, because despite the money that's thrown them and the stars, you know, they are there is a magic about live performance, or even about film performance, and it's a sort of an alchemy. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. And the trouble is, you, however much money you throw at something, you can't sanction for whether the alchemy is going to work. All you can do is try and put everything in place and then hope. And it's what keeps actors coming back for more, because most of the things that actors do are, frankly, yeah, they're okay, but a couple of days later, everybody's forgotten them. But it means that when you have a huge hit, it's a delicious surprise. And when you have a real shocker, it gives you the confidence to say, all right, it might work next time.
Right. And actually proving that point, you talk in your article about appearing in Look, Look in 1990 by the great Michael Frayn. Mm. And that wasn't a hit, is that right?
No, I mean, that was an example of a play that seemed to have everything in its favour. It was Michael Frayn. It was essentially, I hope you'll forgive me for describing it in such terms, but it was essentially a three-dimensional extension of Noises Off, which was his great yep. play. Noises Off was set on a stage, and of course it's been his biggest, arguably his biggest hit. This was also set on the stage, but it was a far more complex conceit. And he'd written it originally as a sketch for a big charity show in London, and it had gone down barnstormed, and everybody said to him afterwards, "What a wonderful 25 minutes! You've got to turn this into a full-length play. Come on!" So he did that. Stephen Fry was in the lead. Robin Bailey was one of the great comic actors. A very, very good cast, and it cost a lot of money. There were probably 16 or 17 of us in it. I had to sign up 52 weeks in the anticipation of success. Stephen was even signed up for 6 months himself, which is a long yep. time when you're Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
And we opened at the Old Witch to great fanfare. And you'd have thought that nothing could go wrong, but the fact was the play just didn't work. The conceit of the play was too complicated. It was a very, very torturous previews. And eventually there was a sort of sense that this wasn't quite working. And Michael, to his great credit, started to rewrite the second half in sort of 8-page chunks. And we'd come in at 2 in the afternoon before the next performance. Michael would dish out what he'd written that night. We'd rehearse it. Often we'd try and learn it. And then put it in. And then, so over a period of about a week and a half, the second half completely changed. But he couldn't fix it. And it closed after 5 weeks. And an interesting coda to this, which is perhaps his apposite to what yeah. we're talking about, Michael Frayn wrote about it in the Sunday Times when the dust had settled, and he, to his great credit, admitted, he said, "I went to see a run in the rehearsal room just before you went into the theatre, and I could see that what I'd written wasn't going to work.
But,
of course, I had to try and make it right." And it's no good in putting his head in his hands and saying, "Oh, my God, this isn't working," because we've got to go on and do it every night. So Michael moved heaven and earth to do that. But it is an example of how, despite every component seemingly being in place, sometimes it just doesn't get lift off.
It's fascinating. And then you finish with a brilliant description of you appeared in the original musical production of Mamma Mia, is that right? Which, as you say in your article, and I love both the film and the musical, but it sounds, on paper, a disaster. Did you think that when you signed up to it?
Well, in truth, by the time I signed up for it, it was a year in.
Right.
So I knew that I was joining the most successful show in London probably since Les Miserables, and arguably including that. So it was a procession of joy for me, because I knew that it was going to be fantastic, because a year on. But there, when I joined the company in Mamma Mia, a lot of the company, the one I joined, had already done a year in it. So I heard anecdotally through the rehearsals their tales of the preparations for the original opening night, when of course they didn't know what they had. And I certainly remember as an actor walking through the streets of Soho and running into people saying, oh, have you heard about Mamma Mia? It's, you know, it's this thin story about somebody on a Greek island, they're shoehorning all these ABBA hits into it. I mean, what a car crash that's going to be. You know, I hope you've got your tickets, because it's not going to be on long. Yeah. There was that sort of schadenfreude that the acting profession has. We don't mean it. We're just trying to keep ourselves warm, really. Yeah. But they went up on the opening night, the cast, and there was quite a sense of, you know, let's prepare ourselves, because this may be shot down in tomorrow's papers. But of course, as another example, the audience were the final arbiters. And on the opening night, the audience just decided that they were going to not only be entertained by its kitsch nature, and some of it is kitsch, but that there was a universal truth to the story, that of a woman struggling to bring up a teenage daughter, seeing her daughter preparing for a wedding day, having to kiss goodbye. And that, I think, had a very profound effect on particularly the essentially middle-aged audience who were coming to relive their ABBA youth. It dealt with subject matters that many people in the audience were going through themselves as middle-aged people. And it was immensely moving. And certainly, in the performances that I did, the scene where Donna, the heroine, helps her daughter into the wedding dress on the eve of the wedding the next day on the Greek island, there were many occasions when we could hear. I was stuck on stage because I had to come on for the next scene, so I could hear. I was sequestered behind a big piece of scenery, so I could hear the audience every night. And there were many occasions when I could hear the sound of sobbing from middle-aged, particularly
that's slipping
middle-aged
through my fingers. Is that
slipping
right?
Slipping through
yes,
my
so
fingers.
Very moving.
It's
yeah,
a beautiful
yeah,
melody.
Yeah, yeah.
And anybody that says that ABBA, you know, were just sort of
genius
tunesmiths, they were much more than that. And this, as you said, Harry, it's a beautiful number, and it really touched people. And I think the success of ABBA is that the success of Mamma Mia is that it succeeds at the same time on two levels. It is wonderful kitsch. Let's go out on a Saturday night entertainment, but it has enormous heart. And what is interesting, and perhaps this is a final point on it, is that of course since Mamma Mia, this recipe has been attempted to be replicated many times. You know, oh, we'll do this musical and we'll do this and we'll put these songs in and make it into a big confection. And some work, but many don't, because that vital ingredient of something magical, you can't sanction for it. You just have to put it out there and cross your fingers.
And actually, you're appearing in the film sequel coming out this summer, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Can you tell whether that's going to be a hit while filming that?
No, I can't, but I don't say that. I don't say that through any other reason than what I've described, is that I would think Meryl Streep won't know whether it's going to be any good, because you can do the same thing again and it might work and it might not. It would seem to me that it's got all the components of a wonderful re-celebration of Mamma Mia 2, and I really hope it works. But I would think even the director Ollie Parker would be the first to say, until we put it in front of an audience, we won't know. It may be that the audiences have had enough of it, or it may be that they just love going back and hearing some more ABBA songs and seeing Meryl Streep and Pierce Brosnan and all the cast. I wish it well, because it's not a cynical exercise. That they really are putting a lot of love and craft into it. So it's not just a money-making thing. They've got something to say. But you'll have to watch this space.
And could you tell us it's going back in time? Is that right, the film?
Well, I believe that there are flashbacks to when Donna is a younger woman herself.
Right.
So there is certainly a 1970s sequence, but I think the majority of the film happens today with the characters now happily ensconced in their new lives.
Right.
But if I tell you I don't know what happens, it's because I don't. I haven't read the full script.
Right. I greatly look forward to it. Well, Annabelle Sampson, the Aldi digital editor, is here. I don't know if you've got any questions, Annabelle.
if you read a negative review of a first night theatre performance, do you feel very disheartened, or do you feel like, right, I'm going to go back and prove those theatre critics wrong? How do you respond to that?
Well, there are two types of actors. There are those that read their reviews, and there are those that read their reviews but say they don't. I do know of one actor who used to keep all his reviews but never read them until after the curtain down on the final performance, at which point he would burn each review over a candle flame in his dressing room over a glass of port. And that's probably the best thing to do. Reviews can be, they can be very deadening, particularly as they tend to come out in the immediate aftermath of the adrenaline-fueled lovey glory of an opening night, when you're out there, and it's usually the next day when you're waking up at 9 a.m. with a slightly heavy head that you find out what the critics make of it. Actors never give up on something, so there will always be a "we'll show 'em" attitude when they go in for subsequent performances. Even in the cases of plays that have been absolutely panned, the cast will. I've never known a case where the cast have given up or not gone in with a sort of Churchillian feel of "we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on." The change happens after the final performance. You will very rarely get an actor to be disloyal to the product in which he's appearing until curtain down. The moment after the curtain down on the last night, they will tell you what they really thought of it.
Really.
Within minutes, they'll say, "Well, I always knew that was a dreadful play. I mean, what a waste of time that's been." But ask them before it comes down, and actors are incredibly loyal. And we have an ability. We have to have an ability to kid ourselves, because otherwise you couldn't go on. Because once you feel embarrassed or really self-conscious going on stage, knowing that what you're doing is terrible, you can't act. It relies on confidence. So we have to kid ourselves that the critics are wrong and that we're right, and that the audience tonight will see that for the first time.
Who would you say is to blame for a flop? Is it the screenwriter, the director, the actors?
It can be anything. It can be any one of them. I mean, occasionally it's the actors. I think perhaps less so now. I think particularly in the movie world, actors are so powerful that often if they don't want to do something that will serve the script but perhaps won't serve their public image, that can bring down a performance, you know, can bring down a project. I mean, this is many years ago, but I do know of a story of Terence Rattigan's play Separate Tables,
yeah,
where Rex Harrison, I think, was in the original and just refused point blank to play the part as it was supposed to be played, because he didn't see that it fitted in with the image that he wanted to disport of himself. So actors, if they get too powerful, they can warp something that otherwise would be wonderful. I think that's happening slightly less now. But sometimes the script just doesn't work. And sometimes the script works, but the director is no good. And sometimes there isn't enough money and it looks cheap. Or, as in the case of many projects now, you can come up with a film, but somebody's just done a miniseries on the same subject that was a huge hit 8 months before. And people say, "I've seen this, what do I want to come and see this again?" It's funny how projects often come along like London buses. You don't get anything, and then you suddenly get two Jungle Books, or you get two, you know, major movies dealing with the same subject. So this is why it's so impossibly difficult to sanction for what's going to work or not.
Do you think the hit flop dice roll applies to all creative industries? So books. So as the author of a book, do you think that it's impossible to tell when you're writing it, this is going to be a great commercial success or not? Or do you think that in different industries you can anticipate this is going to be incredibly successful? So books or magazines, music?
I imagine, I'm not an expert on some of these fields, but I imagine that it's just as difficult some of the best-selling authors that are friends of mine assure me that even despite a very hefty back catalogue and a very loyal following, that they never know whether the next one's going to work. You know, I mean, it'd be very interesting to talk to somebody like Bill Bryson about this, you know, who sort of, the moment he announces that a book's going to be published, you know, it would fly off the shelves. But, you know, it is difficult to keep up standards. As regards magazines, a friend of mine recently had an idea for an antidote to the Oh Yes magazine called Oh No, which just fixes on people's marital disasters, flops, books that are absolutely terrible. You sort of think, hang on, there might be
could
an
be
idea
there. Yeah.
This could be a huge hit. And I mean, look at Viz. Who would have thought that Viz would have worked? You know, a more puerile idea you could never have imagined, and yet it was fastened on by the chattering classes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been known to buy it myself.
Yeah.
That's the glory, I think, of the creative arts generally, is that you just, there is no recipe for it. And it's that gives you hope when things are at its worst, that the next one might work. And it keeps your feet on the ground when you think you've cracked it, because you never have.
Well, I think that's a very good point to end. And thanks so much to Michael Simpkins for a brilliant Oldie podcast and a brilliant article in the March issue of the Oldie magazine.